From Odyssey, I'm Lauren Berry, and this is the On Deadline podcast, where you get a closer look at stories from our radio newsrooms across the country. Today On Deadline is going nuclear as we look at the ongoing global conflicts and a recent call to bolster the U.S.'s arsenal of nuclear weapons. As the world continues to watch conflicts in the Middle East and Ukraine unfold, many have wondered for months, even years, if we're going to be thrown into another world war. You've heard former presidents and politicians, pundits and experts, and even us here at On Deadline ponder this question. While now, as other nations around the globe begin bolstering their nuclear arsenals, a group of lawmakers are pondering whether or not it's time for us to have a nuclear arms buildup. But just last year, the U.S. reaffirmed its commitment to moving forward with disarmament of nuclear weapons. So what's led up to this reincarnation of the nuclear arms race that had school children prepared to duck and cover in the 1980s? Let's start with the Middle East. There, Iran is continuing to pursue its nuclear ambitions, leaving many worried about the country becoming directly involved in the ongoing Israel-Hamas war. Then let's go to the most pressing factor. Russia and its continued war in Ukraine. At this point, it's been dragging on for more than 2 years. However, Ukraine has recently changed its tactics. It's begun assaults on Russian-controlled land in Crimea and in the nation itself. Neighboring Russia is China, which has continued to grow its number of missile silos in recent years. A report from the Defense Department predicted last year that China had 500 operational nuclear warheads, and that number could likely grow to more than 1,000 by 2030. Nearby China, North Korea has continued missile testing. That country welcomed Russian President Vladimir Putin as the nations continue to grow closer together. Putin, Kim Jong-un, nukes. Three things you probably don't want to see joined together in one sentence. So, with all this going on, what will America do? James Acton is co-director of the Nuclear Policy Program and a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He joined Odyssey to share more on the situation.
Okay, so what do you make of the news that the U.S. and China have resumed informal talks on nuclear security, safety, and those issues?
Well, look, engagement between the U.S. and China, to my mind, is a good thing. There are real tensions between them, real underlying disputes. But, you know, any talks that can help mitigate those tensions, even in a modest way, to be welcomed. You know, that said, I'm kind of skeptical that that China is willing to talk about the details of its nuclear buildup. There were talks a year or so ago in which the Chinese were willing to engage on a number of issues of mutual interest, for example, Iran's nuclear program, but they weren't really willing to talk about their own nuclear arsenal. And I'm yet to see much evidence that China's kind of really willing to engage on that issue.
In recent years, underground nuclear tests have become nearly undetectable. Should we be concerned by the rate at which this secrecy is increasing?
Well, I actually don't entirely agree with the premise to the question there. You know, there is some accusation, speculation that China may be conducting some extremely low-yield testing that is very hard to detect. That kind of testing is really only useful for nuclear safety. It's not terribly useful for designing new nuclear weapons or new capabilities. The kind of much larger testing that would be needed for that purpose is easy to detect. You would absolutely know if China or Russia or anyone else had been doing that kind of testing. And I think, you know, for us in the United States, we don't want to see a world in which there's a widespread resumption of nuclear testing. And I think this is a really good reason why it would be a mistake for the United States to start nuclear testing again. We've done more tests than Russia and China combined historically. We know a lot more about nuclear weapons than they do. And, you know, if we start testing, which is something that Trump's former national security advisor was advocating the other day, then that would give Russia and China carte blanche to follow and conduct large-scale testing. And actually, I think we would lose some of our advantage in nuclear weapons knowledge.
How concerned should the average person, not just Americans, but people around the globe be to being on the brink of nuclear war?
Well, look, I mean, I don't think we're on the brink of nuclear war today. On the other hand, I do think the trend lines are in the wrong direction. Nuclear risks are rising. The possibility of a conflict involving actual nuclear use is higher than I think it was 5 or 10 years ago. The good news is it's not as bad as it was during the Cold War. I think people tend to look at the Cold War through rosy-tinted glasses. I think it was a much more dangerous fraught place than people remember now. But unfortunately, we're heading back in that same direction. As I say, the trend lines are in the wrong direction. It's really quite difficult to reverse them. But to my mind, that's an important goal right now.
What about this idea of, you know, mutual assured destruction? I mean, should people find any comfort in the fact that, you know, if they use their weapons, we'll use ours?
Well, mutual, right, so kind of summarize what mutual assured destruction is. It's the idea that in the event of a nuclear war, if it escalated, if it didn't just remain limited, both sides could inflict completely unacceptable damage on the other side. And, you know, there's a debate about whether you can escape from mutual vulnerability, whether by attacking the other side's nuclear forces preemptively and using missile defenses, you can escape this condition. To my mind, you can't escape this condition. This is a fact of the world, it is not a policy choice, and that we cannot meaningfully escape mutual vulnerability, and that we shouldn't try to do so, because if you try to escape mutual vulnerability, if we were to start building more nuclear weapons in order to threaten Russia and China's nuclear forces more, they would respond by building up their nuclear forces, and that would negate whatever advantage we were trying to seek. So, you know, mutual vulnerability, as I say, like, I don't love the idea of being vulnerable, and like, you know, I live close enough to the Pentagon that a very large nuclear blast over the Pentagon would kill me too. So, you know, I don't love the fact of mutual vulnerability, but it is a fact. It's not a choice, and the consequences of trying to escape it are actually worse than the consequences of living with it.
Putin made a rare visit to North Korea last week as the countries continue to build their relationship. The visit came after State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said that North Korea unlawfully transferred dozens of ballistic missiles and more than 11,000 containers of munition to Russia in the last few months. That was after it asked the country for assistance in its invasion of Ukraine. Both Russia and North Korea have denied these claims. As North Korea reportedly helped his nation, Putin took time to defend his new ally, saying that he supported North Korea's efforts to defend itself and its interests in what he said was decades of U.S. economic pressure, provocation, blackmail, and military threats. What would a North Korea-Russia partnership look like for the rest of the world? Margaret Brennan from CBS's Face the Nation joined Odyssey to give us the answer.
Quite an interesting week when it comes to a little love fest between North Korea and Russia. What did we experience between Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un this week?
Well, the pictures really are extraordinary to see Vladimir Putin, who rarely travels, have to go and look like he is really buddies with Kim Jong-un, one of the most isolated leaders in the world of the Hermit Kingdoms. Someone who doesn't leave his own country unless it's under the most extreme circumstances, as he did to meet with Donald Trump years ago. But it really underscores what is a growing alliance between these countries. And what we are seeing is sort of a renewal of a Cold War era divide. Why? Because Russia is buying weapons from North Korea. And the concern among U.S. officials is that Russia might be trading something to North Korea for that. Perhaps not just money, but perhaps also nuclear secrets. That is the deep concern among world leaders who are watching North Korea's continuing nuclear development. So this is an alliance of sorts that is considered dangerous. The Biden administration plays it down, saying, you know, this just shows Vladimir Putin's desperation. And that may be the case, because he certainly does need ammunition.
And this has South Korea so concerned that they're even considering supporting Ukraine. How so?
Isn't that interesting? I mean, it really just shows the lines being drawn here in terms of picking sides and what is becoming an increased, don't call it a Cold War, but it feels that way, picking a side between those who are supporting Russia's war in Ukraine, like China is helping Russia do, like North Korea and Iran are helping Russia conduct this invasion and war against democratic government in Europe, while Western countries and some of those allies of Western companies like Japan and South Korea are standing with the West. South Korea has indicated that they would potentially provide more than just humanitarian aid and support to Ukraine, maybe even weapons. At the moment, they have a defense production industry and have been selling to those supplying to Ukraine. But this would be more of a direct versus through a middleman.
While Putin talked the talk in North Korea, he also appeared to walk the walk last week when his Navy made an appearance outside of Cuba. Some downplayed the situation, but ex-KGB agent Jack Barsky shared with The Hill that we should be at least a little bit worried. Vladimir Putin is again up to his own tricks. He likes to scare people, Barsky said. So what was going on near Cuba? Was it a military operation or something more? Robert Murat, a retired vice admiral with the U.S. Navy, professor of public administration and international affairs, and deputy director of the Institute for Security Policy and Law at Syracuse University, gave more insight into the situation.
So what are we to make of these exercises in the Caribbean?
Say, Eric, for you and Margie and your listeners, it's not too much. I mean, this is a routine port visit. You know, in a sense, everything is connected in terms of the relationship that we've got with Russia right now. But this is a routine port visit by a fairly modest, a Russian submarine, a frigate, a oiler, and a rescue tug, and pretty consistent with things that have been happening for some time now.
Is the timing significant, being that it comes less than 2 weeks after the Biden administration said it would allow Ukraine to use some U.S.-provided weaponry?
Yeah, Margie, I would say yes and no. I would say yes because this visit was probably planned well before that announcement, just based upon the time that it takes to get from the Russian Northern Fleet down to Cuba. So I think this was in the van before that announcement went made. On the other hand, you know, the fact that they're, you know, sending, you know, warships down to the Caribbean, not too far from Florida, is, I think, connected to the fact that Russia is continuing to try to put pressure on the United States and all our allies based on what's happening in Eastern Europe.
So what is the Navy and what do our intelligence services learn from watching these ships, looking at them? I'm sure there were U.S. attack submarines following that submarine around that you were talking about. What do we learn from that?
You learn a lot of things from it without, you know, confirming anything that, you know, the U.S. Navy may be doing. But certainly they did release that we had a destroyer and some P-8 maritime patrol aircraft that were, you know, surveilling this group of ships as they went down there, which is fairly routine. And anytime you get a chance to observe any foreign navies, whether it's Russia, China, or anybody else, the Iranians, you do learn things from how they're operating, how they're interacting with each other, and also the capabilities for the platforms they've got, in this case the frigate, the submarine, and the rescue tug.
The ongoing global conflicts and our relationships with allies and enemies are going to have a major role in the upcoming election. President Joe Biden continues to try to achieve peace in Gaza, to support Ukraine, and to grow our relationships with our allies. But his opponent is expected to hit him hard on things that some say haven't been working. Former President Donald Trump has routinely said that if he were in office, the two ongoing wars, that is, the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza and the Russian invasion of Ukraine, would have never happened. He explained how that could have been avoided by U.S. intervention. Trump has also vocally opposed NATO, while Biden embraces it as a way to keep peace in Europe. On nuclear weapons, they also differ greatly. Biden believes climate change is the greatest danger the world faces, while Trump believes the same of nuclear weapons. The former president said in a recent speech that, quote, "The biggest problem we have in the whole world is not global warming, it's nuclear warming." And here's what Biden has to say. "We have a crazy SOB like that guy Putin and others, and we always have to worry about nuclear conflict. But the existential threat to humanity is climate." This show is produced by Joe Heedy, Christy Strouser, and by me. I'm Lauren Berry, and I want to say thanks for listening to On Deadline, Odyssey's serving of a top news story just for you. Subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts to stay informed.